ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we hear skeptic Michael Shermer probing Stephen C. Meyer, author of Return of the God Hypothesis, on the question, how do you think God does the things you claim he does in the natural world? How does an immaterial mind affect material reality? Well, Meyer is ready for him. It's the third part of four in a series originally published on Shermer's Skeptic podcast.
What's your sense or what's your hunch? Like, if you think that mind intervened periodically, say in the Precambrian or the Cambrian or creation from RNA to DNA or bacteria flagellum or the blood clotting sequence or whatever example you want to use.
Prokaryotes to eukaryotes, one of my favorite.
Does the intelligence create a universe with laws of nature that grind along and create complex forms like ice crystals or something like that? And you presume that he doesn't reach in to do that, but periodically needs a little boost. Like, well, we have prokaryote cells. I'm going to reach in there and glom them together into eukaryote cells. So that was an intervention there. So two things, you're claiming that it's not constant. In other words, it's not like God intervenes in a deistic way. The whole running universe and all the laws, that's God. You don't mean in a deistic way or pantheistic way that way, right?
No, I have a theistic, and I think probably a biblical theology of nature in addition to the arguments that I'm making from nature to God. So that would be the difference between natural theology and theology of nature. And there's an ancient theological distinction in both Jewish and Christian theology between what the Christian medieval theologians call the potentia ordinata, the ordinary power of God, which we see manifested in the ongoing and regular concourse of nature, which we dubbed in that period of time the laws of nature, the laws being, after all, a juridical metaphor of theological origin, to quote one historian of science. Our whole notion of law, the law-like nature of nature, is a theological concept that helped give rise to modern science. But in addition to that, many theists have held that there is another power of God, which is sometimes called the potentia absoluta, the fiat power of God, the ability of God to act as an agent within the creation that he otherwise sustains and upholds, to act discreetly. And I think that since we can detect the activity of intelligence, and I've made an argument that the kind of intelligence that we're dealing with is neither deistic nor alien, but rather that when we look at the ensemble of evidences that I address in the book, that we have evidence for the activity of God at the beginning of the universe and down the timeline as well. Insofar as we're dealing with that kind of intelligence, I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that God may have acted more than one time in that discrete way, even as he upholds the laws of nature on an ongoing basis. Discrete infusions of information into the biosphere suggest to me intelligence, whereas I don't think, for example, mutation and selection does a good job of explaining how large infusions of information arose. I think mutation does a great job of explaining how minor modifications might have arisen, or more generally, how information is degraded, but I don't think it's a good explanation for the origin of information.
Take something like embryology.
So, one other thing, this is about sensibilities. You said glommed onto, and we use the word intervene, and that's kind of so if you're operating out of a naturalistic or materialistic framework or worldview, the notion of God acting discreetly is often caricatured as an intervention to fix something that was broken, like it was a watch and then it broke, and then but it might be more like a great composer who's adding a new variation on a theme. And we don't think of human action in sequence as somehow beneath our dignity. So I don't see that it would be beneath God's dignity.
I don't think that.
Nor is it inherently disreputable to think of God once, if you accept the existence of God in the first place. And I think there's good reasons to do that.
Yeah, no, I don't need to go that direction, because I was going to bring up embryology. If you just look at the embryological development of a human fetus, I mean, the word miraculous is often used, and for good reason. It is just amazing that this cell knows
it's
to become
stunning.
A kidney
stunning.
Cell. This one's a heart cell. That one's the toenail. How does it do this? I mean, and as you know, this is a big debate in embryological circles. Okay. Is it your sense that God designed the embryological system of development from DNA at the beginning and it unfolds naturally, or does the intelligent designer need to intervene at each cellular division to push it? Okay, that cell goes this way and that cell goes that way, and this stem cell is going to become that cell and so on. Because if it's the former, then why can't the whole universe just be wound up from the beginning? And that's what God did. He designed these laws to unfold in adaptive, complex ways and so on, and end up with the complexity we have.
Yeah, well, let's say for the sake of argument, I entirely accept that that all the information in a fertilized egg is present to unfold without any subsequent intervention. I know some scientists who are so blown away by what's going on in embryology and by the who have made informational calculations that wonder if there might be inputs along the way. I don't hold that view, but I'm not necessarily precluding it. I mean, it is an amazing, our friend Paul Nelson, whom you know, uses the marching band analogy, you know, that all the cells know where to, you know, where to go and how to differentiate one from another. And it's stunning. It really is an amazing process. And there must be an amazing amount of information in that fertilized egg. And it's not all in the DNA. That's a crucial thing that I draw out in Darwin's Doubt. You have these hierarchies of information in the distribution of cell membranes and the cytoskeletal arrays and the sugar code, the intercellular signaling. I mean, it's a fascinating subject.
So is it your sense that
let's say it's all there? Yeah, let's say it's all there in the embryo and it's just unfolding. You said, why couldn't it have been that? I have no in principle argument about why God couldn't have front end loaded everything, but what I have is a very extensive empirical argument in chapter 15 of the book about why it looks extremely unlikely that that's what happened. If you look at the structure of the DNA molecule, and it's very hard to synthesize nucleotide bases under realistic conditions without investigator interference. But let's give you a prebiotic soup with sugars, phosphates, and bases, and let's let the self-organizational chemical interactions between those molecules do their thing. You do not get an information-rich DNA molecule. You can examine the DNA structure, the structural formula for a DNA molecule, and you'll notice that there are no chemical bonds along the axis that contains the information between the individual nucleotide bases, and that the bases attach to the backbone with the exact same kind of bond in each case. So there's no chemical biasing as to why one base attaches in one part of the molecule as to another. So there's no underlying chemistry that explains the sequential arrangement of the bases, which is the informational property of the molecule. Now, so what's the argument? The argument is that if the DNA molecule if the highly relevant biologically subunits of information carrying molecules do not have inherent self-organizing tendencies that would explain the origin of the information that DNA contains, then surely we do not have in the elementary particles or in the plasma right after the Big Bang, the information necessary to build a DNA molecule. If it's not in the biologically relevant subunits, it's not in the elementary particles or the plasma. And to try to even conceive of a molecule that we don't even get atoms till 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So the front end loaded idea of design, I just don't think works.
Well, then your sense would be that the mind then reaches in to stir the particles in some way to say, bring those proteins together or create these hydrogen atoms or something like that.
Yeah, I think mind affected matter, and I think we see the evidence of that without knowing how. Yeah.
Yeah, then the question is, could that all be part of just the laws of nature? Here, let me channel Scalia and Rehnquist in the Louisiana creationism trial that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is from my chapter in Why People Believe Weird Things on this, because it was an interesting case in which the ACLU lawyers argued against the creationists that that these people are just teaching, they're sneaking religion in to the classroom. And Rehnquist then says to the ACLU lawyer, Jay Topkis, my next question is going to be whether you considered Aristotelianism a religion. And Topkis says, of course not. Rehnquist says, well, then you could believe in a first cause, an unmoved mover that may be impersonal and has no obligation or of obedience or veneration from men, and in fact doesn't care what's happening to mankind. Topka says, right. And Rehnquist says, and believe in creation. Topka says, not when creation means creation by a divine creator. And Rehnquist says, and I ask you again, it depends on what you mean by divine. If all you mean is a first cause, an impersonal mover. And Topka says, divine, your honor, has connotations beyond I respectfully submit. And Rehnquist says, but the statue doesn't say divine. Topka says, no. Rehnquist, all it says is creation. You know, so in other words, Rehnquist is arguing, well, what would be wrong with teaching an Aristotelian the laws of nature have teleology built into them, and that's the creating force. That's still a materialistic, you know, kind of naturalistic take on creation, but still slightly different than what evolutionists are arguing, and I think different from what you're arguing.
Well, let's set aside the whole, you know, church-state jurisprudence issue. That's another whole can of worms. So we'll go off on another tangent there, Michael. But the laws of nature, by definition, describe regularities, patterns that repeat, sun up, sun down, all unsuspended bodies fall. I drop the ball, I let go of the ball, it drops. And by definition, they describe what are in the information, what in the information sciences is described as redundancy, a repetitive order. The thing that we need to explain in the origin of life is not repetitive order, but rather aperiodic specificity, also known as specified complexity, the term that Leslie Orgel first applied to the DNA in origin of life studies. In other words, information. Information is not reducible to computational algorithm or to simple law-like descriptions that can be expressed as, for example, differential equations. And the fine-tuning is subject to the same problem. So I think that that the laws of nature do a good job of describing regularities. Self-organizational models of the origin of life do a good job of explaining what doesn't need to be explained. What needs to be explained in life is not simple order in the sense of redundancy or repetition or regularity, but rather aperiodic specificity, what we mean by specified or functional information. And that, in our experience, is precisely what always arises from an intelligent source. So I don't think positing laws alone will do. In fact, even in physics, and this is a great point that Michael Polanyi made, that the laws of physics are, he said, are dumb without the gift of boundary constraints. We have to, laws describe certain regularities, but to describe the universe in its specificity, we need what are sometimes also called free parameters. We have to specify initial conditions. We have to specify the strength of the force constants and in the fundamental physical laws, and we need to say something about, we need information about the boundaries of the system that we're describing, what are called boundary constraints. All of that kind of information always comes from measurement and observation. So there's a kind of mythology in physics that laws explain everything. Rather, they describe regularities, and we can't even use them to generate specific predictions unless we also have information about initial and boundary conditions. So I don't think positing law alone will explain the universe in all its glorious specificity and information-rich content.
Here's what I wrote in Why Darwin Matters. By the way, my only book with full frontal nudity on the cover.
I remember that book. That was like 2009, I think, right?
2006, yeah. The ultimate answer to the design inference is to provide a cogent theory of natural design that account for the complexity of the universe and life. This we have through the sciences of complexity, in which we recognize the properties of self-organization and emergence that arise out of complex adaptive systems. Self-organization means that the system requires only an input of energy into it in order to generate an action which comes from within the system itself. An emergent property is one that is more than the sum of its parts. Complex adaptive systems are those that grow and learn as they change, and they are autocatalytic, which means that they contain self-driving feedback loops. So that would account for your bump in complexity or whatever without an outside source. I use several examples, language, consciousness, water, the law, the economy. I mean, no one designs an economy.
Michael,
the only thing regulators can...
language and consciousness, well, let's just use the Nobel Laureate prize on you right away. I mean...
Well, let's use the economy as an example. No one designed it. The only thing governments can do is regulate it and put restrictions on it and tax it and so on. But just you and I trading and so on, out of that emerges this incredible complex system without any outside input. It's just, you know, individual persons doing exchanging. Isn't that something like
making free choices intelligently guided, though? This is not an analogy that's apt for describing how basic physical laws will generate information-rich molecules. And I really go into considerable depth in all three of the books I've written, Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt, and the new one, on the problem associated with self-organizational models of the origin of life. And even self-organizational models of the origin of body plants, they only get anywhere if there's large inputs of unexplained pre-existing information. The kind of processes that are cited as examples of dissipative, non-equilibrium self-organizational systems are things like tornadoes, draining bathtubs, where energy is moving through a system, but it produces a simple form of symmetric order. It doesn't produce the aperiodic complexity that you find in biological systems. I used to have an illustration of this that I used with students. Two big Coke bottles filled with liquid with blue dye in it and sparkles. If I put energy through the system in a Prigogine or Stuart Kaufman-like way, I would get a non-equilibrium system. I would get order arising as a result of that energy input. It'd be a nice, beautiful spiral vortex. Fair enough. But those little sparkles did not line up and say, Steve Meyer did this. The higher level order was the result. You still had lower level randomness. There's just some very powerful critiques now of these self-organizational models. Brian Miller, a PhD in complex systems physics from Duke, who's now one of our research coordinators here at Discovery, wrote an excellent article at Inference, the journal that David Berlinski edits, in response to Jeremy England on this whole question, these newer models of self-organization based on what are called dissipation theorems. And they really don't work in explaining the origin of life because they need information. Even dissipative systems, to get anything that's remotely complex, have to have an equivalent amount of informational input at the beginning. And most processes that we know are producing order spontaneously with simple energy moving through the system are giving a simple form of redundant order, not specified complexity. So I just don't think that's a very compelling alternative explanation of the origin of life.
Okay. Let's go back to how the mind could operate within the physical universe here. I'm going to quote Sean Carroll from one of my Scientific American columns, that if we follow this trend that I was talking about, what place is there for such paranormal forces as ESP or supernatural agents like God? Do we know enough to know that they cannot exist? Or is it possible that there are unknown forces within our universe or intentional agents outside of it that we have yet to discover? According to Caltech physicist Sean Carroll in his book, The Big Picture, quote, all of the things you've ever seen or experienced in your life, objects, plants, animals, people, are all made of a small number of particles interacting with one another through a small number of forces. Close quote. Once you understand the fundamental forces of nature, such as the thermodynamic arrow of time and the core theory of particle and forces, you can scale up to planets and people and even assess the likelihood that God, the soul, the afterlife, and ESP exist, which Carroll concludes is very low. But
let's talk about scaling up.
Yeah, okay.
You used that phrase a minute ago too.
Okay,
the crucial thing in all these ideas about emergence. Michael Polanyi wrote two really profound articles in the late 1960s, one called Life Transcending Physics and Chemistry and another called Life's Irreducible Complexity, or Life's Irreducible Structure. Behe was the irreducible complexity guy later. And one of the points that Polanyi makes is that at each level in what we would call a hierarchy, where if you were an emergentist, you'd say that you had scaled up, that the possibility space of the lower level has been significantly and often incredibly tightly constrained. The basic law, the fundamental four laws of forces, allow for a vast ensemble of possible events. And therefore, for example, the law of gravity allows apples to fall and astronauts to fly to the moon. But the law is operative in both situations. What accounts for the difference is not the law. The law isn't the difference that makes a difference. What makes a difference is the constraint on the arrangements of matter that allowed engineers to produce something like the Saturn V rocket. And yes, they implemented knowledge of other laws of chemistry, laws of propulsion. But at every point in that ensemble of possibilities, constraints have to be applied to get the specificity, in this case of engineering, that allows a completely different event to occur than one you normally expect, which is that objects fall. And so the underlying laws at every level are not what's responsible for scaling up. What's always involved in scaling up is constraints on possibility space, boundary constraints, and that involves an input of information, because whenever you're saying, we're going to go, we want A, not B, zero, not one, this constraint, not that constraint, we're imparting information. So scaling up requires, emergence requires information inputs. And my argument is that, again, that information is the product of mind. It comes from, in our experience, it's minds that constrain possibility space to achieve functional outcomes. That is to say, it's minds that generate information. So I always find the emergentist account of things really lacking in specificity. It seems like a slogan without that doesn't really address the underlying problem, which is what constrains possibility space at each one of these hierarchical levels that allegedly emerge from the lower level.
Yeah. Well, so again, how does the mind do this? Which forces is it using? Carroll's point here, continuing with quotes from him, take the core theory of particles and forces, which Carroll says is indisputably accurate within a very wide domain of applicability, such that 1,000 or 1,000,000 years from now, whatever amazing discovery science will have made, our descendants are not going to be saying, ha ha, those silly 21st century scientists believing in neutrons and electromagnetism. Thus, Carroll concludes that the laws of physics rule out the possibility of true psychic powers. Why? Because the particles and forces of nature don't allow us to bend spoons, levitate, or read minds, and we know that there aren't new particles or forces out there yet to be discovered that would support them. Not simply because we haven't found them yet, but because we definitely would have found them if they had the right characteristics to give us the requisite powers. And then he goes on to talk about God in the same way. Leave out ESP.
I get what he's doing there. But here's the thing. We have observations from our direct introspective experience about what minds can do. We also know what our human minds can't do. We have knowledge of their limitation. So I'm with you. I've never been... When you're skeptical about the spoon benders, I say, go, Michael, you know, you get them. But one of the things that minds do, and we can cash this out in abstract conceptually, is that minds constrain degrees of mathematical freedom. They constrain possibility space. You and I are doing it as we're using language. We have a nearly infinite array of possible sounds and symbols that we could babble back and forth at each other. But on an ongoing moment-by-moment basis, we are carefully choosing sounds and symbols, words and syntax, semantics, in order to convey our meaning one to another. And amazingly, we're able to do it. Now, so we know minds have that power, and it's precisely that power that's necessary to constrain the possibility space that gets you from physics to chemistry, chemistry to biology, and especially to actual living cells. I mean, to the information that's needed to produce living cells. So we don't know how minds do that, but we are in a real-time experiment, you and I right now, using our minds to do that. We know minds have that capability, and we're looking at features in life that require that capability. And I've unpacked that argument more in the books. I think digital code, hierarchically organized information, a tightly integrated information storage, transmission, and processing systems are solely... in our experience, the product of intelligence. And when we find those at the foundation of life and even the simplest living cells, this is not an irrational leap to conclude that a mind played a role in the origin of those systems as well.
Yeah. I think you're familiar with my little thought experiment, what I call Shermer's Last Law. Any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence would be indistinguishable from God. And I would just expand that to say far future humans or anything like that. I mean, just take a look at this from just, it says 2007. I mean, this is another miracle, right? So,
well, no one believes that the iPhone arose without Steve Jobs, right?
Right. So, let's say we've
got a strong basis.
If we discovered ETIs, As Sagan always said, they're not going to be like just 5 years ahead of us or behind us. They're going to be like 5 million years ahead of us. And they're not going to be behind us if we encounter their technological signals or whatever. So, you know, just look at what we've accomplished in, say, the last century of science and technology. If you made that 100,000 years of history or 1 million years of history, you know, anything that we can imagine a God could do, they could surely do. It's just engineering and technology and knowledge, right? And so could it be that the mind is, and also Michio Kaku talks about this, that whatever the aliens are going to be like, they're probably not going to be physical beings anymore. They're probably going to be just minds in computers or something like a cloud, you know, beaming around the universe on laser beams or something.
The universe is computation hypothesis, an ID hypothesis.
Okay. So that's right. So could it be a super advanced intelligence, not a personal God in the Christian traditional sense, but just some kind of higher intelligence like that?
Yeah, excellent. But you do a great job of marketing your ideas too. Those are memorable. I mean,
I'm not as good as Dawkins.
I need to work on that. What'd you call it?
Shermer's last law, because I don't believe in naming laws after
Shermer's
yourself.
Last law. I need a first law and a last law.
Yeah.
Newton had three. He got three laws, and he became
pretty
famous.
Well, of course, I stole it from Clark.
Yeah. Well,
who stole it from Newton?
Did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. So I actually addressed that hypothesis. It's whether you call it scientific or metaphysical. I don't know. I never really care about those classifications when we're dealing with these ultimate issues. But the panspermia hypothesis is effectively that. It's the idea that a very advanced intelligence that evolved by undirected, strictly materialistic processes got so advanced that it could figure out how to create other forms of life and seed them here on planet Earth. And no less a personage than the great Francis Crick actually floated this idea in his book, Life Itself, which was a little book on the difficulty of the origin of life problem. Dawkins, I think he regrets this, but he floated the idea at the end of an interview with Ben Stein in the film Expelled, when he acknowledged, there might be a signature of intelligence in the cell, but it would have had to have come from some other intelligent being somewhere out in the cosmos that also evolved by undirected material processes. In the book, I argue, I take that hypothesis on as a competing hypothesis to the theistic God hypothesis. And I argue that it has two deficiencies with respect to the ensemble of evidence that I'm examining about biological and cosmological origins. One, it doesn't really solve the problem of the origin of life, because to get the evolutionary process going, we now know that anything worthy of being called life requires a large input of information to, again, constrain the arrangements of matter to produce something that is self-replicating and has metabolism and an enclosure and so forth. So to get anything worthy of being called life going, you have to have an input of information. And that has proved to be incredibly difficult from the standpoint of underlying chemistry, including self-organizational processes. So pushing the problem out into space someplace doesn't actually solve it. Problem number one. But the deeper problem is that no being within the cosmos can account for the origin of the fine-tuning from the very beginning of the universe upon which its own evolution would subsequently depend. Nor can such a uber intelligence within the cosmos account for the origin of the universe itself. So when you look at the ensemble of evidence we have about biological and cosmological origins, not only the evidence of design in the information-bearing properties of DNA, RNA, etc., but also the evidence of design that we have in the fine-tuning and the evidence of a discrete beginning to the universe itself, I think that theistic design provides a better overall explanation of that ensemble than a space alien, however omniscient it might have evolved to be.
That was Stephen C. Meyer speaking with skeptic Michael Shermer in part 3 of 4 in a series originally hosted on Shermer's podcast channel. For more great questions and answers on intelligent design, stay tuned to ID the Future at your favorite podcast app, or find us at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.